Second Thought is a 100% viewer-funded operation. If you'd like to help support the channel and get some great perks while you're at it, consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/secondthought. Hey, isn't it weird how every time Congress is about to pass some decently progressive bill, there's always one or two Democrats suddenly ready to come out of the shadows and tip the scales against it? That's not a coincidence. And as much as Biden complains about it, he actually prefers it that way. ...2024 is an election year, and unfortunately for Biden, his approval rating is in the toilet. I won't go through his whole track record, but just to refresh your memory, Biden promised a $15 minimum wage. Didn't deliver. He promised to enshrine the federal right to abortion. Didn't do that either. He promised to cancel about $10,000 of student debt per person, and ultimately came in way under that number. And then, of course, you have the recent stuff with the southern border, where Biden's being far more xenophobic and draconian than most Republicans, even after calling Trump out for the same thing and promising to put a stop to the border wall, which he also didn't do. You get the picture, but politicians never keep their promises, so no one's really surprised. Even now, as we're hearing the Biden campaign make basically the same promises because, trust me, this time is going to be totally different. They just needed more time. Now that he's on the campaign trail, Biden is mostly pinning the blame for this sort of stuff on Republicans. It's time to rally every last Democratic voter behind him, and with a solidly Republican House and a sort of blue Senate at the moment, the reason things like that border bill didn't get through was because it was blocked by a strong Republican opposition. So it makes sense that Biden is really keen on making them look like obstructionists. But that really doesn't explain all the broken promises. For about 2 years, Biden and the Democrats had all the power you can get in American politics. The presidency, the Senate, and the House. Everything swung blue in 2021. People elected Biden on a pretty tame set of progressive promises, ostensibly gave him and the Dems all the levers of power to make them happen and a good chunk of time to deliver, and instead, we got years of disappointment, watered-down proposals, and a we-believe-in-climate-change Democratic Party that's somehow still churning out alarming numbers of new fossil fuel permits. And to explain all that, we heard a very familiar excuse. Back in 2021, for example, Biden said this.
I hear all the folks on TV saying, why doesn't Biden get this done? Well, because Biden only has a majority of effectively 4 votes in the House and a tie in the Senate with 2 members of the Senate who vote more with my Republican friends. But we're not giving up.
It's nothing we haven't heard before. When progressive bills die in the Senate, the story is always more or less the same. Liberal outlets and Twitter accounts start blasting whoever it was that flipped the last vote, whether that's a mansion or a cinema. Biden delivers a passionate, somebody really should do something about this, not me, speech. And that's either the last you ever hear about it, or 10 months later, the bill has a new name, $10 billion in extra defense spending tacked on, and hardly anything left from the original. This sort of thing has been happening for a long time, and it's not without consequence. If you've been following politics for a bit longer, you might remember guys like Joe Lieberman, who, like Manchin today, sort of made being the Democratic Party's rotating villain his whole personality. He's dead now. If you don't remember him, Lieberman was famous for a few things. Being aggressively pro-Iraq war until the day he died, and back in 2009, rejecting Obama's plan to include a public option in Obamacare. The public option would have been a federal health insurance system that could compete against private insurance and drive prices down. In very simple terms, it would have made healthcare cheaper and made private insurers lose money. It's not quite abolishing private insurance the way Bernie's Medicare for All plan would have, but still, it was something. Anyway, in 2009, the Democrats had the votes in the Senate to pass the ACA with a public option provision included. Most Democratic voters and most Americans were in favor. And suddenly, right before the vote, in comes Lieberman, vocally opposing the public option, threatening a filibuster, and because he was the deciding vote, ultimately forcing the ACA to be drafted without it. The public realized what was going on, that even if Lieberman could block a vote by being a dissident and preventing the Democrats from having the 60 votes they needed, like the Republicans under Bush, the Democrats could use reconciliation to pass the ACA with a public option with only 50 votes. Then, once again, out of the woodwork comes Jay Rockefeller, another Democrat-aligned senator suddenly reversing months of his own pro-public option rhetoric and refusing to vote for it because, well, the timing isn't very good. Why wasn't the timing very good? Well, because the timing allowed the Democrats to actually exercise power in a way that would have benefited their constituents. Typically, that's good. But for the Democrats, these are very bad circumstances, because they force them to either find people willing to go back on their word, or actually follow through on their promise. So, why does this happen? Why do we always seem to have these obstructionists within the country's major left party blocking even mild center-left policies? On some level, there's an obvious answer. And, like in most American politics, that answer is lobbying. Take Lieberman. Over his career, insurance companies had contributed nearly $500,000 to his campaigns. Pharmaceutical companies almost certainly played a role too, with Lieberman's wife having several jobs in lobbying firms known for being cozy with Big Pharma, and that would have benefited from Lieberman's obstruction. The same goes, obviously, for guys like Joe Manchin, who is well known for being staunchly pro-fossil fuels and killing every bill that would lessen the US's reliance on them. Between 2017 and 2022, he was the number one recipient of oil and gas and auto industry money to the tune of several million dollars. And you can say the same about centrist Democrats in the House. Earlier this year, 8 House Democrats asked Biden to lift a pause on liquefied natural gas export permit approvals. According to Jacobin, 4 of them received more than $1.6 million in oil and gas donations, and the other 4 got more than $300,000 from the energy and natural resources industry. This flies in the face of a Democratic Party that is very publicly outspoken that climate change is an existential threat. But those examples are all very direct, somewhat out-in-the-open campaign donations. If receiving money from lobbying groups while in government doesn't sound like enough of an incentive, there's always the reassurance of the revolving door. See, being despised by your party might make your seat a little less stable, might make your party more reluctant to select you for candidacy for your state, and might generally attract a lot of hate you might not want to endure for decades. For those who don't like being public targets, there's always the option of bowing out and getting just a regular lobbying gig where the connections you made in Congress are incredibly valuable. And sure enough, roughly 60% of retired lawmakers land in jobs where they end up influencing federal policy for significant salaries, at least in the exiting class of 2019. That's the case for Joe Donnelly, a conservative Democrat named as a partner in 2019, his centrist friend Doug Jones, and your favorite, Joe Lieberman, who left office back in 2013. This possibility to cash out by staying cozy with corporate lobbyists matters to conservative Democrats. How do we know that? Because none other than Joe Manchin told us so back in 2021, when he opposed the For the People Act that would have slowed down this revolving door and made it harder for congresspeople to become federal influences. Manchin wrote his own version of the bill that cut that specific ethics provision and would set up him and his centrist buddies for the foreseeable future. But let's get back to Lieberman for a second, because the especially egregious cases of this lobbying influence are probably best represented by his group, No Labels. No Labels is a nonprofit/political party started in 2010 with the purpose of bringing together centrists and moderates in the US to grab seats from progressives. Their rhetoric is predictably uninspired and mostly characterized by calling themselves representatives of the common sense majority, while throwing everybody who doesn't work with them under the extreme header, in a country with 2 nearly identical parties. Anyway, No Labels doesn't publicly reveal who its donors are. As a nonprofit, that's technically allowed, if a little weird. But the problem for them is that that hasn't stopped journalists from figuring this stuff out. And as you probably expect, well, it's a lot of classic Republican donors who would not be disappointed at all with having a few spoilers in the ranks of those who caucus with Democrats. Louis Bacon, a regular GOP donor, gave No Labels about $1 million to elect more centrists, for example. James Murdoch, former chief executive of 21st Century Fox, the parent company of Fox News, put in at least $500,000. Nelson Peltz, a big Trump donor, put nearly $900,000 into the No Labels super PAC. I think you get the idea. According to Open Secrets, No Labels has something like 8 super PACs playing with several million dollars. And frankly, those 3 names barely scratch the surface. There's a lot of demand for people willing to act as spoilers to aid the Republicans, and centrists have a lot to gain from playing that role. But if you're like me, this explanation doesn't feel complete. It's not that lobbying doesn't matter. You can always find deep wells of corporate money going to these centrists and flipping their votes. But it's just not the full picture. It doesn't explain what's in it for the Democratic Party, who, by all accounts, not only let this happen, but actively play a role in keeping it going. So why doesn't just pointing to lobbying feel like enough? For starters, conservative Democrats don't always get the most campaign donations, from corporations or in general. If the only explanation I gave you for why are they like this was money, that little piece of evidence would pretty much crush my whole argument. There's other ways to make money than to be a self-interested fence sitter, and plenty of Democrats get just as healthy a check from being regular partisans. Oftentimes, though, you'll hear that the explanation for rotating villains has something to do with the villain of the week's constituents. If some Democrats are more conservative, the conventional narrative is that they're probably just a better representative of a more conservative district or state. But that's not what the voting records show. Take a look at Glusenkamp Perez from Washington. She's part of a group of conservative Democrats called the Blue Dog Coalition. And beyond how lame calling yourself a blue dog is, you might remember her from her time in the villain seat as a vocal opponent of student loan forgiveness. Quote, "She was one of just two Democrats to vote for a proposal that would have thrown out the entirety of President Joe Biden's student debt relief plan, and would have also retroactively reinstated interest payments and reinstated some already forgiven loans. Since joining Congress in January 2023, she's voted with Republicans more than most of her Democratic colleagues, according to Slate. And especially surprising for a Democrat, that included voting for a Republican NDAA bill that restricted abortion access for those in the military and targeted DEI initiatives at the Pentagon." Now, Glusenkamp Perez flipped her seat from red to blue in 2022, sure. But that does not make her district especially red among House Democrats, nor can it explain these votes. Mary Peltola, a representative from Alaska, for example, ran in a state that Trump carried by 10 points last election, double his lead in Glusenkamp Perez's district. And she never voted against either that student loan bill or the NDAA anti-abortion stuff. Because she didn't need to. So if neither constituency nor lobbying alone can explain these obstructionists, what does? The answer is the American political economic system. Its design and the power it gives corporations through a gridlocked Congress. We tend to think of congressional gridlock as the government not working. Gridlock, obstructionism, rotating villains, they all give us the impression of a government that suddenly stops and locks up its proper function. And indeed, that's the core of the Democrats' rhetoric. Democrats campaign on being bipartisan and working across the aisle because it's necessary to overcome gridlock and return government to a proper state of affairs. But that's not the case. At least, not according to Sheldon Wolin. In Democracy, Inc., Wolin spells it out pretty clearly. Quote, "The true significance of near gridlock is not that it paralyzes governmental action, but that it prevents majority rule. Sharp and nearly equal divisions, the stuff of gridlock, are in the interest of some powerful groups who would be less influential, more threatened by majority rule. What is made more difficult by the politics of stalemate is the capture of state power to advance the social interests of the many." In other words, in a gridlocked Congress, power doesn't come from an electoral majority or the interest of the majority of citizens. Power comes from the control of a small number of seats. Control that great sums of money purchase for maximum effect and can easily outweigh what little power a majority of Americans can have through voting. According to Wolin, achieving this state of gridlock is crucial to the interest of a party like the Democrats. While the Republicans can be unabashedly pro-business, as the party meant to represent the left, the Democrats have to play a different game. While claiming to represent the interest of the majority, quote, "the poor, minorities, the working class, anti-corporatists, pro-environmentalists, and anti-imperialists," they also know that in a two-party system, these people don't have any other powerful representation. There is no viable third party for those who reject putting corporate profits first. And that means the Democrats can simultaneously use the rhetoric of progress while remaining competitive by catering to the interest of corporations who fund them just as much as their opposition. Democrats always need to remain a pro-business party if they want to stay in power. They also need to be seen by enough of the voting population as the only home for progressive politics. To square that circle, the Democrats need to have politicians who allow them to profess their supposed progressiveness without actually needing to deliver on it. As a result, every election becomes about winning this majority through mobilizing voters with progressive rhetoric. And once the seats have been earned, the extent of political participation for most people is now reduced to being upset about corporate Democrats and the lobbyists behind them, and waiting for the next election. Quote, "Gridlock establishes the conditions of electoral politics. In elections, the party set out to mobilize the citizen as voter, to define political obligation as fulfilled by the casting of a vote. Afterwards, post-election politics of lobbying, repaying donors, and promoting corporate interests, the real players, takes over. The effect is to demobilize the citizenry, to teach them not to be involved or to ponder matters that are either settled or beyond their efficacy." Wolin calls this state of affairs managed democracy. It's a system in which, rather than being dominated by the tyrannical majority the Founding Fathers whined about, a careful set of controls is put in place to empower a corporate minority and block any form of majority rule that doesn't align with its preferences. So under this system, winning for the Democrats doesn't mean getting enough seats to do whatever they want. They win the game of politics when they can get just enough seats to do the bare minimum and keep voters coming back without seriously upsetting the corporate backers whose influence is much more important and who they actually need to care about. Now, weakening popular majorities was always built into the structure of American government, with its electoral college, bicameral legislature, and unequal term lengths between the more popular House and the more aristocratic Senate. But the rotating villain strategy specifically lets the Democrats sit back and retain enough legitimacy by letting just a few of their colleagues take the heat for voting against policies they don't want to see happen. And to make this strategy work, Democratic leadership is highly involved in the process of sidelining progressives and keeping their numbers to a minimum while throwing their support behind centrists they'll get to scold down the line. For example, it was recently revealed in the American Prospect that four former directors of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, the official campaign arm of the Democrats in the House, have been working against progressive incumbents to get conservative, centrist Democrats elected instead. This is the same organization that, 4 years ago, while many of these directors worked there, had an official policy against using party resources to attack incumbents. But the difference was that in 2020, the incumbents were the centrists, and now they're the progressives. So attacking them is totally fine. But those are former directors. The fact that they aren't really official Democrats anymore might be enough to dismiss them for some people. Much harder to dismiss, though, are the current Democratic leaders in the House throwing all their weight behind centrists that regularly vote against the party. Back in March, Sludge revealed that, quote, "The House Democratic Leadership Super PAC donated more than $1.1 million to a lobbyist-run centrist group that has worked to undermine the Biden administration's agenda on lowering drug prices, regulating the finance industry, and put hundreds of thousands of dollars behind obstructionists. If the party wanted to actually do stuff when in power, its leaders wouldn't throw so much money at the corporate darlings it knows will block every bill that would fulfill a campaign promise." Case in point, Hillary Clinton just endorsed George Latimer against the more progressive challenger Jamal Bowman in the primary race in New York. Who's George Latimer? Well, according to Clinton, a, quote, "strong, principled Democrat who will fight for President Biden's agenda." According to Latimer's own track record, though, he's a centrist who refuses to raise taxes on the wealthy and will stand behind Israel no matter what. That race, by the way, has become the most expensive House primary ever, in large part because United Democracy Project, an APAC-affiliated super PAC, pumped in more than $14 million in ads for the centrist candidate. And it's not the first time we've seen Democratic leadership do this. 3 years ago, once again in New York, the chairman of the state's Democratic Party, Jay Jacobs, ran the same smear campaign against a progressive to defend the party's centrist option, one of the highest-ranking bipartisan House members, Carolyn Maloney. But don't misunderstand me here. At the end of the day, what the rotating villain trope shows isn't that there are good and bad Democrats. That's not the point. Just about any Democrat can take on the role of an obstructionist. It's nothing exceptional, and many do. Sinema used to be a radical progressive running with the Green Party. That never stopped her from becoming a huge obstacle to progressive policies. The point is that for every somewhat left-wing Democrat opening up space for working-class politics, there is a party apparatus, a governmental structure, and a corporate stranglehold on politics ready to unravel their efforts. For every progressive campaign promise, you can always keep in your head a little asterisk that says, if we feel like it won't hurt our finances too much. And while a few Democrats take the heat for being the flipped vote, the party, and dozens of regular rank-and-file elected officials, get all the benefits of opposing progressive politics without actually having to admit it. The truth is that the Democrats will never be a force for radical change in this country. Radical change comes from the organized masses, and that is not who the Democrats represent. I mentioned at the beginning of the episode that this channel is entirely grassroots funded. Since sponsors don't want to touch videos like these, we have to rely on the generous support of viewers like you. If you'd like to help keep this channel afloat and get some great perks while you're at it, consider becoming a patron on Patreon. All patrons, regardless of pledge amount, get early access to every video, plus access to our patrons-only Discord server. We just made a major update to the Discord, with a revamped leveling system and monthly Discord Nitro giveaways to active members. We've also got a bunch of other cool stuff like a book club, live Q&As with me every month, and a dedicated educator role for users ready to answer any questions you have about socialism. We've built a thriving community, and we'd love for you to be part of it. So if you'd like to join the Discord, get early access to every video, and help support genuinely principled socialist content, consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/secondthought. If you enjoyed this video, leave us a like. If you hated it, a thumbs down. You can check out our other content by following the links on your screen. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time.